Hey, how's it going, guys? Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Gareth Porter's going to be on to talk about a few things. Second and foremost among them, the trial of Jeffrey Sterling, who allegedly leaked details of the CIA's Merlin program to New York Times journalist James Risen. I think you'll like to hear the interview. Also, William Hartung will be on to talk about the F-35. What a piece of crap the F-35 is. And I don't mean that in a Luke Skywalker, ironically it turns out that she's faster than most kind of way. No, it really is just a total piece of junk. F-35. F-16s can beat it. That's why they don't do contests against F-16s. Also, Nebojša Malić will be back on the show to talk about the renewed war and renewed failed attempts at ceasefires and what have you going on in Ukraine. I know it's far enough away that America should not be messing around there. It's far enough away we ought to not have to pay attention to it all the time. But yeah, no, sorry. Our government has made it our business. And in fact, it's probably the most important issue in the world right now. I should have spent these last few years getting my wife to teach me Russian so I can read more of the original sourcing going on here. Well, then that'd be a whole different thing. Teach me how to read it, huh? Anyway, never mind. Point is, Nebojša knows what the hell's going on, and so he's going to explain it to us. And I think, hopefully we can just sum up the coup and the war. I don't know. I'll sum up the coup, and then I'll let him sum up the war, and then go from there. So I don't want to spend too much time. This always happens because I get the idea that people don't really know the background of the story, so we need to fill you in the background, but then we spend too much time in the background, we don't have enough time for the foreground. You understand what I mean? It's probably improper use of the term foreground there. Anyway, so there you go. Nebojša, Gareth, and William. William Hartung from the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. So, whatever. Anyway, he's good on the F-35. All right, and then, so I got some things. First and foremost, I don't know if you saw or read the State of the Union speech last night. And so there's this part where he claims victory in Afghanistan. And then he says, the terror war is still on. Instead of sending large ground forces overseas, George W. Bush, you stupid idiot, we're partnering with nations from South Asia to North Africa to deny safe haven to terrorists who threaten America. In Iraq and Syria, American leadership, including our military power, is stopping ISIL's advance. He still calls them ISIL, Islamic State, and Levant. I don't know why they won't change their acronym to what everybody else says. But anyway, Obama continues to claim here, instead of getting dragged into another ground war in the Middle East, we are leading a broad coalition, including Arab nations, to degrade and ultimately destroy this terrorist group. And then, well, I'll get back to the punchlines in a minute. There are too many of them to stop at each one. We're also supporting a moderate opposition in Syria that can help us in this effort and assisting people everywhere who stand up to the bankrupt ideology of violent extremism. The bankrupt ideology of violent extremism. Is that a thing? This will take time. This will be up to Jeb Bush to pass on to his successor. I made up that part. It will require focus. Sacrifice. But we will succeed and finally get to the part. I call on this Congress to show the world that we are united in this mission by passing a resolution to authorize the use of force against ISIL, he says. And before this speech ever started, Lindsey Graham was on CNN saying that, yes, of course, the Republicans in the Senate are in total agreement with the president on this and will be happy to pass a new authorization to use military force. And, yeah, so now to unpack it a little bit. It'll take time means they have no strategy whatsoever for seeing an end to this thing at all. The ideology of violent extremism is a reference to crushing any who would resist the American empire. That's what violent extremism means. Someone who is part of a state that is not loyal to the United States, or a non-state group that is not loyal to the United States. And sometimes ones that are loyal to the United States too. Kind of goes back and forth, you see. But yeah, violent extremism. Well, geez, there's political violence going on all over the world, man. You just mean those who would resist the American empire. All right, anyway, the moderate opposition in Syria. What he's saying here, in effect, is that I think this is right. I think you got to sum this up. I think what he's saying is Syria will now be a rump state. They got all the major cities. That'll be ruled by the Baathists. But by refusing to just say, okay, look, we're pivoting back to Assad because at least he's a secularist and at least he has the army that we can outsource this war to, that he was referring to above. His army is a more cohesive force than the so-called Iraqi army. And if it wasn't for American intervention against Assad, his forces would have put down this rebellion back in 2011 and 12, and that would have been the end of it. It would have been brutal, and it would have been over. Of course, the Islamic State never even split off from al-Nusra until 2013. So, you know, there's that. But anyway, I think what they're saying is, listen, you got to have independent Sunnistan. You got to break Syria and let the Islamic State or whoever succeeds the Islamic State have, you know, 2/3 of the country. Again, all the city or most of the major cities are in the West. But that seems to be the policy. Now, it could be that they actually haven't argued it that far because nobody in the committee room wants to be on the record actually explicitly stating what it is that they're doing. Wait, so is this what we're doing? Shut up, Jenkins. You're screwing it up. This way, no one's responsible, see? Anyway, there you go. That's their plan. They claim they're going to build up a third force. They're going to create an awakening movement of the Sunni insurgency in Syria that is not Islamist and that is loyal to the United States, and somehow Assad will leave them alone. They won't have to worry about him, and they'll just be our auxiliaries on the ground fighting against the Islamic State in Syria. Does that make any sense at all? As some FSA-style new third force trained by the Army and the CIA can challenge the Islamic State on the ground. I mean, the Kurdish fighters that have been holding them off in Kobani, they already had their own established fighting force. They're not some ad hoc put together piece of crap by the Americans. And just look at what happened to the awakening movement in Iraq. All those army soldiers turned and ran or joined up with the Islamic State. And all that equipment belongs to them now. And that's what's been going on for 3 years straight, really, in Syria, as America and its allies have been funding and arming the Sunni-based insurgency. And then guess what? It's the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State-type fighters who don't mind dying so much. The extremists, if you will, who've been leading the rebellion all along and getting all the money and weapons. And then he has no plan for Iraq other than, trust me, I guess the Kurds will take care of it. But don't worry, we're going to win, though. Your life is on the line for it. On the hook, more like. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, yeah, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Stop by scotthorton.org. Three good interviews coming up here in just a minute. Now, last night, Rand Paul gave his response to the president's State of the Union. And I only read part of it, but he did talk about, he attacked Obama from the left, typically speaking, you know what I mean. On foreign policy. And he basically called, insinuated that Obama and his administration are basically a bunch of neoconservatives, indistinguishable from the so-called humanitarian interventionist do-gooders. And that look at what all the trouble they've caused. And he went light on Syria. I guess he's avoiding picking that fight, at least for now. But he used the same warmed over talking points, honestly. About Hillary Clinton turning Libya into a jihadist wonderland where they swim in our embassy pool, the Al-Qaeda guys and whatever, which I think he really needs to work on burnishing up his talking points and trying to come up with some better shtick. But he's obviously completely right about turning Libya into horrible chaos, but the swimming pool thing and all that, I don't know. Anyway, maybe the focus group said that people went, huh? Oh, yeah. When he mentions the swimming pool, you know, I don't know, could be. Anyway, jihadist wonderland. Okay, I'll take it. But here's the thing: he also said we must defend ourselves and defend vital American interests. And you can drive an entire world empire through a line like that. So in general, he's saying, listen, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are wrong on all this intervention. And he actually casts all of their intentions in the most neoconservative terms, right? Anybody who's for intervention over there are all Wolfowitzians on the at least supposed belief that we can spread democracy and modernity and, you know, Western values and whatever through the Middle East by bombing them. Which, yeah, as much as it's an oversimplification or even an unfair one against all the members of the war party, so... I mean, they're all basically as stupid as that, you know? I mean, the best you could argue for them is that they don't believe it when they claim that's what they're doing over there, spreading democracy. So it's a fair enough criticism. He came out and even agreed with the president that the Congress should not pass these new sanctions against Iran, which could sabotage the deal. And then I don't approve... of him using this language and saying, oh, that risks war, because no, it doesn't, because Iran is still within the Non-Proliferation Treaty and their safeguards agreement anyway. All of their nuclear facilities are safeguarded facilities anyway. All of their nuclear material is verified to have not been diverted to any military or other special purpose anyway. So if the talks fail completely, then we go back to status quo, which is stupid Cold War over a fake non-existent threat of their civilian safeguarded nuclear program. So doesn't really threaten war, but then so what does he do? Because it's such an emergency, we need an alternative. Instead of saying, hey, no sanctions, he's now going to team up with Barbara Boxer and introduce some sanctions of his own. And there's a thing in Politico about it. And the way they spin it is that this is, as Boxer puts it, a moderate alternative to the Kirk Menendez bill. And it's a moderate proposal, she says. a modest one, maybe. We're very excited. Of course, they focus on the bipartisan nature of it. But let me see. There's a paragraph here with a little bit of details. The legislation will seek to allow quick votes by Congress to reinstate some sanctions if the Obama administration finds that Iran has violated any nuclear agreement. Some of those sanctions have been loosened by the interim deal. So, in other words, it's the same damn thing. It's really virtually the same thing as the Kirk Menendez thing, which is threatening to reinstall the sanctions, what, automatically instead of holding another vote if the talks fail. It's the same thing. And it's no less sabotage of the deal. Doesn't seem like. The only way that this doesn't sabotage the deal is if the Iranians say, oh, who cares about the stupid Republicans in the Congress and their various versions of these kind of bills, because the deal is going to work out, and so don't worry about it. Thing is, it's not a sure thing that the deal's going to work out at all, and this kind of intervention by the Congress in the negotiations, even though supposedly it's meant to undercut the attempt to undercut the negotiations, could do the very same thing anyway. It's just like Paul Pillar put it in the National Interest. I'm sorry to keep citing this over and over, but simple enough analogy. What if the Majis, or whatever, you know, Iranian House of Lords, passed a thing that said, hey, if there's any problems with the negotiations, the Americans don't, you know, lift all the sanctions on the exact day and minute that they say they're going to, then we start enriching back up to 19.75% again, and we start reconnecting and spinning all of our centrifuges. And, you know, we vow forever to stay outside of any additional protocol to our safeguards agreement. If they did that, then, of course, all the Republicans in Congress would say, oh, look, see how they're negotiating in bad faith? See what 12th Imam worshiping weirdos they are with their crazy religion that means we can't negotiate with them because of their crazy religion? That's what they would say. The Americans would react that this is a deal breaker. The administration might even too if their government intervened like this. Instead, the narrative all along has been that the Ayatollah has said, go ahead, Mr. President and Mr. Negotiator. Do your best. I support you, but I'm not too hopeful. But I guess we'll see. So he's backing their attempt. But, you know, giving himself an out that he's not throwing all of his weight behind it, because if the talks do fail, he doesn't want to be embarrassed by that. In the same way that Obama keeps saying, oh, chances are less than 50-50. Yeah, because he doesn't want to be caught being too optimistic. He's just trying. That's all. That's the politics of it. Same thing there. But anyway, so I'm really disappointed in Rand Paul. He's voted for the sanctions all along on this, and he could have won this fight so easy. It's such a pattern with him. Same with Obama, too. Why not just win the fight? Why not ever just come right out and say what I just said, which is the plain, simple, easy-to-defend truth, which is there's no scandal here. All their nuclear material is accounted for. You claim to be frightened that they're enriching some up to 19.75%, but they've already turned all that into fuel plates. They're using it for their medical isotope reactor, just like they said they were going to. This whole thing is a tempest in a teapot. This whole thing is stupid. And all Rand Paul has to do is say, listen, I understand that Lindsey Graham can't understand the details of how nuclear stuff works because it's really complicated. All these treaties, I bet when his staff tries to explain to him what an additional protocol to a safeguards agreement is, that Lindsey Graham can't understand. But for Americans who on average are much more intelligent than Lindsey Graham, let me explain it to you real quick. There is no scandal here. We're preventing a civilian program from ever becoming a weaponized one when we have no reason to believe that it has anything to do with ever being a weaponized program at all. He could win that fight. It would be easy. And instead, I don't know, the Rand halfway option, I think, could be just as destructive. That's all I'm trying to say. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, hey guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. All right, on the line, we got Neboj Samalic from antiwar.com. Moments of Transition is his column. Welcome back to the show, Neboj. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. Thank you for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. Lots to talk about. Let's start with the president's big speech last night, the State of the Union. He said America is upholding the principle that bigger nations can't bully the small. By opposing Russian aggression, supporting Ukraine's democracy, and reassuring our NATO allies. So how about it? Tell us about America's support for Ukrainian democracy in their defense against big bully Russia over the last, say, year and 3 months.
Well, if he actually means what he said, I would have expected a full withdrawal of U.S. troops from Kosovo and its reintegration into the constitutional order of Serbia, as mandated by the U.N. Resolution 1244 of July 1999. So obviously he's not really being truthful here. It's a special kind of cynicism to go about this whole Russian aggression thing, because there's... You know, in this day and age, to claim invasion and have zero evidence that it's happening takes a special kind of arrogance and stupidity. I mean, it would take is one guy with a cell phone camera. And there's been reporters crawling all over that place for a year, and not a single credible picture has been produced. Not one.
So, well, and again, they really have claimed invasion repeatedly. Oh my God, thousands of troops are coming across the border, blares CNN, about at least three or four different times where they've really claimed thousands.
The funny thing is that, you know, every time the troops loyal to the government in Kiev, the junta in Kiev, get their asses handed to them, pardon the expression, in battle, the spokesman in Kiev claims Russian invasion. And the joke is by now, you know, what is this, number 35 already? Long story short, over the past 3 or 4 days, the armistice that was signed in September, when the first great disaster befell the government army, has been holding more or less until the beginning of this year, and then the artillery attacks on the civilians in Donetsk started. And then this weekend, the infantry and the tanks launched actual attacks against the rebel positions. And they got creamed. Right now, the entire airport, which has been in government hands almost since the beginning and from which they coordinated the shelling of the city, has been completely taken by the rebels. Latest report is that one of the high-ranking officers, a brigade commander, who also happened to be one of the leaders of the Nazi right sector, has been taken prisoner, as has been most of his unit. There hasn't been a major operation in that, you know, we're talking like a dozen tanks and maybe a brigade as opposed to, you know, divisions. But apparently they've been smashed up really badly. And of course, Kiev's standard response is this is, you know, yet another Russian invasion and whatever. But the facts on the ground are that, you know, they tried a probing attack and they got really badly beaten. Now, everybody that has been monitoring the situation, and you know, every analyst and every observer is going, why now? It's a terrible time. The weather is atrocious. It's just not conducive to a military operation. And why would you go ahead and send, you know, such a small attacking force to get slaughtered? You know, advantage of surprise, whatever, but that obviously didn't work. And yesterday I was actually commenting on this for RT, cross-talking this with a couple of Western analysts, and none of us were really sure what was going on. And it dawned on me this morning, I have to say, it didn't occur to me yesterday, but it dawned on me this morning that these people could have been sent to lose.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it possible that the Nazis are such bad public relations that the more Western-leaning, more America-friendly, technocratic types might have an agreement that let's go ahead and run these guys off into kill zones and thin the herd of right sector Nazis a little bit before they get too powerful in the parliament there?
Well, that's certainly one of the considerations, and a lot of people have been suggesting that, you know, there's a Game of Thrones.
Wishful thinking on my part that the Americans don't want anything to do with these Nazis or something, but that's a ridiculous premise with no evidence to support it. So,
unfortunately, the Nazis do have the U.S. government's backing, which is, you know, terrifying on so many levels. But while there is a Game of Thrones mentality in Kiev, and these people are backstabbing each other routinely, there's another – I think there's a more sinister dynamic at play here. You see, there a U.S. general is visiting this week, and according to reports and rumors, his job is to basically evaluate the situation before making recommendations to the government here on whether and how to implement this ridiculous law that was initialed – but not yet implemented back in December. Something along the lines of Ukrainian Freedom Act. Honestly, whenever the government puts freedom or patriotism in the name of the law, you know it's a bad thing. Nothing good can come of it. But anyway, so this law envisions the American taxpayers providing quote-unquote lethal weapons aid to Ukraine to ostensibly repel the non-existent Russian invasion. And what the government in Kiev is trying to do is make sure that this material, these weapons, and the promised training and all of these things at the expense of the U.S. taxpayers because Ukraine is broke, come sooner rather than later. And they've just called for a new wave of mobilization, a new draft of some 50,000 people, including folks over 50 years old, which is somewhat insane if you think about it. And already there are reports of mass defections and, you know, people basically fleeing the draft, a lot of them going to Russia, the aggressor to escape from, this is how much the aggression and invasion narrative holds water. So my theory right now, my working theory is that they tried to launch an attack that they knew would fail in order to show the visiting U.S. general that they really need all this aid and that there's a huge danger of quote-unquote Russian aggression and that therefore if you would pretty please send us a few billion dollars worth of weapons and equipment and instructors.
Yeah, that makes plenty of sense. I mean, that's basically the game all over the world is, hey, the Americans are here. We have to show them that we're just strong enough that we're the horse they ought to bet on, but we're just weak enough that we need a lot of money and guns, please. Thanks. And the same game's going on in Kurdistan right now and all over the place.
Right, and this isn't This isn't the first time. I mean, I've seen this before in Bosnia. I've seen a regime trying to basically get U.S. intervention to win the war for it, and they were willing to do unspeakable, horrible things to even their own people in order to secure this, in order to make this happen. And when it finally did happen, it didn't work out at all the way they planned. And the peace treaty they ended up getting was the same peace treaty they rejected 40 years prior after the American ambassador said, well, you know, we'll have your back if you don't sign it, and then proceeded not to. And, you know, they remain pissed off to the present day that, you know, the Americans, quote unquote, betrayed them. And as a result, you have people from, you know, you have frustrated and peeved Bosnian Muslims going to fight, you know, in Syria, in Iraq, you know, being caught staging terrorist attacks in this country, that sort of thing. I mean, it's one of those, okay, you know, you have a great plan to manipulate the great big powerful empire, but hasn't it occurred to you that the great big powerful empire came into being by essentially being more manipulative than others?
Right.
You know, who are you trying to make it, you know?
Well, you know, and we'd like to believe
the mafia, it's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, we'd like to believe that the people running the American government will only go so far. They wouldn't really sacrifice, you know, D.C. for Kiev. But I don't know if we can count on that. We'll be right back in 1 second. It's Nabot Somalis from Antiwar.com and the Gray Falcon blog. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show.
And I should not be emailing and tweeting and doing all these things during the break. Should be reading or recording through it anyway. All right, I'm on the line with Nebojša Malić from antiwar.com, and we're talking about the war in Ukraine. It's still going on there in the eastern provinces. It's pretty clear, as even Holland of France said the other day, President of France said, oh, come on, it's not like Russia wants to reconquer Eastern Europe or even wants to reconquer Eastern Ukraine here. He's only taken Crimea for the reasons that everybody already knows. And he obviously doesn't even want Donetsk and Luhansk. So we can put all that, and pardon my pronunciations, so we can just put away all the narrative here and get back to reasonable business. We never meant, he said, to try to break the entire Russian economy with these sanctions. We just wanted to punish them a little bit. Well, that ain't what Obama said in his speech last night. He's bragging. In fact, boy, if this isn't hubris, pride before a fall kind of a thing. Well, today, it's America that stands strong and united with our allies while Russia is isolated with its economy in tatters, he crowed.
That's a specific type of arrogance that is really unbecoming of a man who, much as I want to like the guy, he's been like this for years. Just taking credit for stuff he never did, getting recognitions just for showing up, not really ever amounting to much. And now he's just lying about stuff. I'm sorry, but he is. All of the actual economic indicators are showing that, yes, while, the GDP in Russia has shrunk, so has ours. And in fact, all of his clever hashtags in the speech and, make sure to Twitter and Instagram who are his speechwriters trying to appeal to? The jobless millennials? Oh, yeah, our economy is great and strong. And no, it isn't. Have you looked around? I mean, I dare anybody to say,
hey, we're living here, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, which bubble does this guy live in? I know
DC.
Washington, D.C. is a pocket dimension. I live here, too. But come on, it's impossible that, we're living in the same universe here.
Well,
it's easy
and in fact,
somebody to, yeah.
There's a great article over at Consortium News where the guy points out that, in fact, the guy is quoting even Thomas Friedman getting something right. I don't know. How's that confirmation bias for you? Saying that, hey, part of having a globalized economy means that you can't really take down Russia without taking down yourself. Because if they default on all their bonds, well, guess who's invested in all the European banks that are invested in all those Russian bonds? American banks. It's all one big integrated thing. And so you're only shooting yourself in the face.
Well, the thing is, and this is, I've actually spent the past year researching this and going to meetings and listening to experts on all sides just to educate myself about this some more. And what I've walked away with is that the only thing that this quote-unquote sanctions regime, which is essentially a trade blockade and violation of all sorts of international norms, it could be even construed as an act of war. The Russians have chosen not to do so because they're honestly being quite reasonable about this, more reasonable than they should be. The only thing it's managed to accomplish is essentially to separate Russia from the Western financial system. And paradoxically, while this hasn't, the thinking in the West is, oh, this is going to hurt the Russians so much that they're going to overthrow the government. The government's never been more popular. And what they did was destroy the pro-Western liberals in Russia who have been trying for the past, ever since 1991 and the rise of Boris Yeltsin, who was essentially an American puppet, to reshape Russia in a Western mold and make it just another European country that would follow the lead from Washington. And it's these people that are the most vociferous complaining today because their entire concept has been destroyed by Americans themselves.
Well, and you can see where they're coming from with that. I mean, the Americans couldn't have gotten – I mean, the imperialists, not the American people.
Right.
The imperialists, they couldn't have been luckier than to have Boris Yeltsin up there for, 9 years or 10 years?
Well, it wasn't luck. I mean
– Well, yeah. No, I mean – but and they couldn't have had it better is what I mean to say. And you can see why they're not over it and they want to have that again. On the other hand, we're talking about Russia here, and just by definition, that means that their military and security services and that kind of thing, they take their job real seriously. Obviously, under Putin, the government is virtually coup d'etat proof. I mean, other than, you know, an American daisy cutter bomb on top of the Kremlin, you know, when he shows up for work in the morning. I don't know how in the world they can imagine they could ever have anything like a Boris Yeltsin regime in their hand again. And that ought to be okay, too, that, you know, maybe they can be independent, but still we can get along. We have a better relationship with China than we do with Russia, but why? You know?
Well, that's the thing. And the same group of people today that is, you know, boasting clever hashtags and clever, you know, Tumblr graphics has gone a long way to antagonize China as well. You know, China's keeping this country afloat by buying all the dollar bonds. Without the Chinese, you know, without the Chinese servicing our debt, so this country would have to actually work for a living. So again, it just boggles the mind that these people have no understanding of economics at all. They believe that war is peace, and that you know, slavery is freedom, and that weakness is strength, and all these ridiculous things, you know, that clever graphic at the State of the Union speech showing that how the U.S. leads 31 nations. Yeah, well, if they had actually put the graphic of the countries that stand with Russia on this, that would be 3/4 of the world's surface.
Yeah. Yeah, so, the graphic again, is, you know, this is, interestingly, the White House, they posted the text of the State of the Union on Medium.com because I guess that's the trendy thing to do. And 2015, and it has this graphic. It says the U.S. is leading a coalition of 31 countries in coordinating sanctions against Russia for its aggression against Ukraine. Hashtag America leads.
I know this has got to be some sort of joke, right? I mean, last summer at this conference, trying to sort of bridge U.S. and Russian leaderships and find a way out of this, you know, restarting Cold War, I've heard information, fairly reliable data, that the U.S. and Russia trade balance is negligible, even though the two countries are neighbors, whereas the Europeans have a much larger trade volume with Russia. And it's essentially the Europeans that are paying the bill right now. It's the European economies that are being driven into poverty. I mean, the Greeks are on the verge of collapse. They have an election in a couple of days, and most likely the party that will win the election is going to lobby for exiting the European Union, because the European Union, with the sanctions policy, is bankrupting the country yet again after they've just been bankrupted to death a few years back. So, and you've got Spain, you've got Italy, you've got all these countries that were hoping to rebound from their financial crisis because the bankers had overleveraged them. By exporting their agricultural produce to Russia, bam, sanctions, can't do it.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Germans, who are most eager to go along with the sanctions regime, have safely exempted their own trade with the Russians from it, and, you know, Lord forbid their gas supplies get cut, that sort of thing. You know, the French are suffering because they were exporting their luxury goods to Russia, can't do that anymore. You know, the Baltic states are going nuts because for all of their anti-Russian rhetoric, they relied on exporting food to Russia. Can't do that anymore. You know, and it's only logical. If somebody hates your guts, why do business with him, right? From a libertarian standpoint, the Russian sanctions on Europe are perfectly legitimate. Okay, you people have decided to, you know, boycott us. Fine, we'll boycott you back and you know, see who hurts more. But the U.S. is laughing all the way to the bank because, hey, you know, we got the Europeans to bankrupt themselves for us. Ha ha.
All right. But now let me ask you this, as we're running out of time here. Back to the front, as old Metallica would have said. If the Americans can give enough welfare to the Kiev junta that they can actually win outright in the East, would you expect the Russians to go ahead and intervene like they've been accused of doing all along with actual troops on the ground to prevent that? And it seems like, you know, the obvious solution would be some kind of very federalized autonomy type situation is, you know, the solution that Kiev is not interested in whatsoever. So I guess I just wonder how bad you think it's going to get or crap. Music's already playing. You know what? Let me just record you into the break here for a minute.
Okay.
And for the rest of you, sign up for the podcast feed there. Okay, good. But yeah, so I wonder, you know, they've had quite a few attempts at ceasefires here. The Russians are saying they want a ceasefire again. I don't know how genuous or disingenuous they're being with that necessarily. But I don't know. Seems like peace could, what I was saying about the obvious solution, seems like peace could break out pretty much immediately if these guys would come to obvious terms. On the other hand, the war keeps going and the Americans keep backing the junta in the West that refuses to accept that level of autonomy in the East. So.
Well, the problem is there's two problems at work. Both are essentially tied to the nature of the government in Kiev. One, the very identity politics they adopted is rooted in about a 100-year-old hate project that sought to define Ukrainian identity as intrinsically anti-Russian and hostile to Russia. And what they're trying to do is impose this identity that has been trying to every time there was some sort of war, whether it's World War I or World War II, there's been a fringe trying to impose this and failed every time. And this is why, you know, there's crying about their glorious World War II past fighting for freedom alongside Hitler. So they can't really have peace with Russia because it's against everything they stand for as a political group as an identity group. But on the other side, there's also the notion that, again, America has their back. Their belief that the U.S. government, who, you know, they don't care about the American people, neither does the U.S. government for that matter, but their belief is that the U.S. government has their back and all it takes is, you know, money and weapons and whatever, and they'll just, you know, kill all these subhumans, as they've called them before, and, you know, liberate our holy land, whatever. And, you know, there's even people dreaming of going into Russia itself and, you know, quote unquote, reclaiming ancestral Ukrainian territories. Madness. On the other hand, there might be even some people in Washington, and this is a topic of much debate, that would like to see Russians intervening openly because their whole agenda is, okay, let's have a new Cold War. Let's, you know, look how well that worked out the first time. This is a way to revamp our economy. This is, you know, the war is good for business idea. And obviously they're horribly mistaken. But again, this could be it's an explanation for how some of these people might be thinking. And so what they've been wanting to do ever since March and the Crimean referendum is basically provoke a Russian intervention. Basically say, okay, you know, the Russians have invaded. We must, you know, intervene to curb Russian aggression and so on and so forth. What they don't realize is that the Russians have nukes. And so do we. And, you know, playing this sort of game with a nuclear power is insane.
Yeah.
So, again, what their end game is, I don't know. I've heard plenty of speculation that this is some sort of, some sort of plot to bolster or revive the dollar or whatever, you know, when you're in a recession, start a war, and people have been reading too much Keynes and looking too much into FDR and World War II. But again, war can't be good for business if both sides have nuclear weapons. We're talking sea of glass scenarios here. So I honestly hope that the people who are, you know, in charge downtown here aren't that stupid, but I wouldn't put money on it.
Yeah. Well, and even in the worst of the Cold War, we never actually had an H-bomb exchange. But think of all the dead Koreans and Vietnamese and Indonesians and on and on and on.
Right.
Name
and
every
and
Eastern
be,
European country right. dominated by the Soviet Union.
And it could be that they're thinking, okay, well, Ukraine is just another one of these proxy wars. You know, it would be like just like Vietnam or whatever, or Afghanistan. The crucial thing that escapes them is that Ukraine is not just a neighboring country. It is the Russian heartland that was partitioned and sort of, you know, they've had this whole new identity created over the course of the 20th century at the hands of Russian enemies. First the Austro-Hungarians and then the Germans and then the Nazis and then the communists. And so what they don't understand is this very crucial dynamic. It's as if, you know, a hostile state started creating an anti-American country in Canada, and the American public wouldn't stand for this, or Maine declaring independence and becoming rabidly anti-American tomorrow, or California or Texas, you name it. It's essentially it's not considered a foreign country to most not just ethnic Russians, but people in Russia in general. It's part of their country and culture and part of their cultural space. And so for the U.S. government to be sponsoring a rabidly anti-Russian Nazi government in that country, which the Russians were happy enough to leave well enough alone as an independent state, but cannot possibly tolerate from any standpoint, politically, morally, culturally, you name it, its existence as an anti-Russian fortress on their very border, is madness. It's madness. And whoever came up with this idea in Washington, thinking it was brilliant, is an idiot and needs to be put on trial.
For stupidity.
Which, for stupidity. Which, and also grand treason.
Washington, D.C. levels ought to be prosecutable, I think.
Yeah, for real.
Absolutely. All right. Hey, I kept you over time. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, y'all. That's Neboj Samalic. He's at grayfalcon.blogspot.com and, of course, at antiwar.com/Malik, M-A-L-I-C. It'll forward right on it. original.antiwar.com/Malik. Back in a sec with Gareth Porter.
Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, check it out. I got Gareth Porter on the line. He's an independent historian and journalist, among my very favorite. He's the author of Perils of Dominance about Vietnam and Manufactured Crisis about the Iranian civilian nuclear program, despite what you may have heard to the contrary. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Scott. Glad to be back.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. First of all, let me ask you about the news out of Argentina. You've done some very important work in the past, at least two or three different articles for Interpress Service. I think pretty significant, pretty definitively debunking the story that Iran and Hezbollah were behind the bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, back in 1994, and that really it was local Nazis and the cops helped cover it up and this and that. And yet, all the news is saying that the prosecutor who heroically tried to defy the wishes of the bureaucracy to tell the real truth that Iran and Hezbollah were behind it was recently shot in the head, and nobody really believes it was a suicide, and it's a Washington Post, a conspiracy theory everybody at the Washington Post can love. And so I wonder what you think about these recent developments.
That's a good question. And I mean, the answer is I do not know what to make of this, except for the reality that I think everyone agrees to, that the justice system in Argentina is so horribly corrupt and politicized that no one will ever believe what comes out of this process. And that's why, I mean, my closest contact in Buenos Aires, who I just spoke with this morning, who was really a key source for my investigation of the Buenos Aires bombing, because he was a part of the team, the legal team that was working on the case for the Jewish Community Center, he is just as skeptical about the story of suicide as people in the streets. And I take that as a very serious indication that the credibility of the government's apparatus for handling these sorts of cases is so low that it's going to be very difficult to figure out what actually happened. It's supposed to be a locked bathroom. How that could be faked, I don't know. But the point is that no one believes the official case in Argentina.
Oh, that's easy. You just lock the door and close it behind you, right? That's that's not hard.
The point is that except for the political hacks who are supporters of the present government. Basically, nobody from left to right, tends to believe the official story about this.
Right.
And that's, and so I want to detach that question from the issue of, the accuracy and the authenticity and integrity of the work that Nisman, that is the prosecutor, Alberto Nisman, did with regard to the investigation and the indictment of the Buenos Aires bombing, which, genuinely was a political hack job. I mean, it was simply not a serious work of a prosecutor. It was extremely political, and there was no real evidence cited. I read the entire 800-page indictment in English, and I can tell you that it didn't hold up at all. It was just, there was nothing there.
Hmm. All right. Well, speaking of judicial processes, who's Jeffrey Sterling?
Jeffrey Sterling is the former CIA control officer for the CIA asset called, who they called Merlin, or they have decided to call Merlin for the purpose of this case, at least. And he is, of course, on trial for having allegedly leaked the story, revealed the story of Operation Merlin to James Risen of the New York Times.
And so, he's been on trial for how many days now?
Well, this is the second week of the trial. I believe this is the fifth day, if I remember accurately.
And you've been attending all the...
I have not attended all of them. I've attended three of them out of the five. This morning I stayed home and I'm trying to finish two articles on the case. But the articles are really less about Jeffrey Sterling than about Operation Merlin.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think probably a good part of our audience is familiar at least with the background of this story. But again, I guess as you just explained it, funneling some blueprints there and didn't all work out. Risen from the New York Times got a hold of it. So what's new? What have you learned about Operation Merlin from attending the trial?
There's a great deal that's new. In fact, what we learn from the evidence that's been introduced at the trial, what I've learned from the evidence introduced at the trial, is that Risen's account of the critical moment, if you will, in the operation when the asset they call Merlin for the first time saw the actual plans for this device they call a fire set, and there are other names for it, but that's the term that was most often used in the trial and in the CIA cables that have been introduced into evidence. When he saw those plans, according to Risen, he said, "Oh no, this is not right. They're going to, that he spotted a flaw and that the Iranians would be able to therefore spot the flaw as well and use the device to create a nuclear weapon." That's really not the way it happened. And this is corroborated by not just the CIA cables, but by the testimony of both Merlin and his handlers, that what actually happened was that he spotted a discrepancy between the so-called schematics or the actual physical plan of the device and the list of parts that was accompanying it. In other words, there were parts listed that were not shown in the schematic, and he immediately spotted that. And what he was afraid of was not that the Iranians were going to be able to use this device necessarily, to create a nuclear weapon, but rather that he was going to be found out, that his cover story would be become obvious, that he was really not, somebody who was representing a bunch of Russian emigres or former Russian scientists who were the ones who designed this, and he was trying to peddle this to make some money. So that's a bit of a different storyline. than the way it was presented by Risen. And I'm not in position to try to explain how that happened, but he clearly got a misimpression. He was misinformed. He did not have enough information to get that detail right. But the story that's actually told in the declassified CIA cables, which are an extraordinary new source for CIA covert, a major CIA covert operation. Well, I don't want to call it a major operation because there wasn't that much to it, but a significant, politically significant CIA covert operation. You know, what we learn from these cables tells a story that is, in my view, just as damaging or really more damaging than the story that Risen told.
All right, now hold it right there because the music's about to start playing and we got to take this break. But it's Gareth Porter, everybody, from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net, author of Manufactured Crisis on the Iran Nuclear Program. And he's talking about the trial of Jeffrey Sterling, who's accused of leaking the Merlin story to James Risen about the U.S. government, the CIA, giving nuclear weapons blueprints to the Iranians, sorta. Back in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. And I'm sorry I screwed that up. Jeopardy music playing on me and everything. That's the whole point. No, it wasn't nuclear bomb blueprints. It was just a fire set. It was just one small part of a thing. Anyway. Didn't mean to overstate that on the way out to the break. But the point is, you're saying that the new narrative that you've picked up from this trial, quite differently, or quite different from James Risen's story of the Merlin plot, is just as instructive. How's that?
Well, it's hardly, it's difficult to know where to begin because there's so many things about this operation that are so outrageous. But I want to begin with what seems to me to be the biggest implication of the story. What I learned from reading the CIA cables and putting together that information with the work that I've already done on the faulty intelligence that has been put out about the Iranian nuclear program almost from the beginning, is that this operation actually had the effect of distorting the official assessment of the CIA and the intelligence community about the Iranian nuclear program, not just once, but actually twice. The first time that it happened was towards the beginning of not the beginning of the planning for the operation, but when the Counterproliferation Division, which was the office of the CIA that actually dreamed this scheme up, first got the CIA to really sponsor the operation with the White House, with the Clinton administration. And bear in mind that this operation could not take place without a presidential finding. According to legislation, which was passed in 1991, which formalized a practice that had begun even before that after Iran-Contra, no covert operation can take place without a presidential finding. And in order to get the finding, you have to go through a rather elaborate process. And so, of course, the CPD needed the CIA brass to support it politically with the White House and with the Clinton administration. When that happened, when they finally got that support, of course, that meant that the CIA was in a position where it had to be telling the Clinton administration that it believed that Iran had a nuclear weapons program, because otherwise there was no rationale for this operation. That was the key rationale for carrying out this this phony this effort to sell the Iranians on a phony fire set. The fact is that until that moment in 1999, the CIA was not saying that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. It was saying, well, we suspect that they intend to do that, but they could not say, and they would not say, that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. But the moment they embraced a covert operation and supported it with the White House, that changed. And I've been able to pin that down now. And that's one of the stories that I'm going to be writing about this. That's part of one of the stories. So that's the first time that this operation became the reason for the CIA to actually change its assessment, its official assessment of the Iranian nuclear program. The second time actually was after the operation was carried out, but refused to die, because even after this fiasco of Merlin going to Vienna and so being so afraid to encounter an Iranian official that he never actually entered the Iranian mission. And there's more to be said about that. But after that was all finished in March of 2000, the program continued, and they were hoping, of course, that Iran was going to somehow want to contact Merlin, and they never did. But they were even talking about extending the program to another country, which has been unnamed, but it's recounted in one of the CIA cables. And so by 2001, I mean, apparently this whole Operation Merlin was still going on. And so when the CIA undertook its 2001 National Intelligence Estimate on the Iranian nuclear program, it was still in the situation of justifying this Operation Merlin. So guess what happened? They not only came out with an NIE that said that Iran had a nuclear weapons program, they also suppressed in 2001 very important human intelligence that had been acquired by a very talented undercover operative for the CIA. And I tell the story in my book about this. They suppressed the intelligence that Iran never intended to weaponize, had no intention of weaponizing. And of course, that would have completely scotched the rationale for Operation Merlin. They couldn't let that happen.
So wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand you right here, Gareth. You're telling me that they started the program in the first place to see what they could find out about the Iranian nuclear program, to kind of infiltrate it, build that up so they could know whether or not the Iranians were making nuclear weapons. But in order to justify the program, they had to claim that they already knew they were making nuclear weapons in order to justify going to these lengths to infiltrate it. And then they ended up pretending that they didn't know, outright pretending and denying information that said that they don't have a nuclear weapons program, just in order to continue the operation to find out whether they do or not.
To continue it and to justify the fact that it was carried out, of course. But let me just,
even though it never did work.
Exactly. But there's just one point here that I want to clarify.
Okay.
And that is that the initial objective of Operation Merlin was twofold. This was always from the very beginning. There were two purposes. The first one was precisely what you said. It was to try to find out what the Iranians knew and what they were doing in regard to their nuclear program. I mean, in other words, it was in a way a backhanded admission that they really didn't know what they were doing. But the second part of it, which was always, you know, the thing that they were most interested in was this fire set that they thought they were so clever about getting a national laboratory to create. And it was this technology that really drove Operation Merlin from the very beginning. This was the big thing. This is what they really wanted. And of course in order to actually justify to the White House that they were going to turn over a fire set that supposedly the Iranians couldn't make work, and it took a long time for them to get all the official confirmation and an official, document that said, no, the Iranians could never make this work. They had then to be able to say, yes, we believe that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. So, that's why, you know, it was the technology that was at the center of Operation Merlin that really drove the CIA for the first time to say that Iran does indeed have a nuclear weapons program.
All right. You know what? Hey, sorry, live audience. We'll be right back with William Hartung in just a minute. But, Garrett, let me ask one more question into the break here, if that's all right, for the recording later. And that is that Ryzen has said that, I believe I'm paraphrasing him correctly here. Part of the reason he thought it was so important to go ahead with this story, even though Condoleezza Rice and everybody came down on the New York Times and had them not print it, but the reason he wanted to put it in his book anyway was because he had seen the administration build a case for war against Iraq, and he didn't want to see them do that again, and it looked like they were building a case for a nuclear weapons program in Iran in order to justify the next stage in boiling cauldron plan there, and that he decided that, you know, if they were going to do it, it would be important to point out that the information isn't accurate, if in fact he can, which in fact he writes, and I don't know Ryzen's record on this, but he claims at least that he was really good on Iraq's WMD in the back pages of the New York Times back then.
Well, I assume that that's correct. And of course, it's, you know, as I'm sure you have countless times on your show discussed, it is absolutely true that the neoconservatives in the Bush administration precisely had the intention of using false intelligence, the false idea that Iran had a nuclear program to justify the use of military force against Iran. And in 2006, when Ryzen published his book, that was still very much a live issue. It was only, as we've discussed in the past, to 2007, 2008, that the plan to somehow engage Iran militarily finally fell apart and was never revived.
Mm. All right. Well, with that, I'll leave you. But thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
Hey, all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is William D. Hartung. He is the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. And his latest for the, the Huffington Post, is Can the F-35 Be Stopped? What a good question. Welcome back to the show. William, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Very happy to have you on. So here's the thing. Before we get to the question of can the F-35 actually be stopped or not, we got to get to the question being raised in the first place, which is why should it be stopped? And I was wondering, here's my challenge for you. I want to see how many things wrong with the F-35 you can name in one breath. Ready? Go.
Unaffordable, unneeded, unworkable. Well, I guess that was my breath.
I was reading this thing the other day. They were talking about the machine gun doesn't work. The camera can't pick targets. Obviously, as we all know, you can't fly it in the rain. The fuel can't be stored anywhere where there's a desert nearby because the fuel won't burn if it's too warm. So I guess they need new refrigerators for the gasoline trucks. And anyway, on and on and on. I was reading the helmet doesn't work. The stealth doesn't work. It can't hit ground targets. It can't do a damn thing. Is it true that the F-35 could be killed by any other fighter jet in the Air Force or Navy's inventory, the F-16, the F-18? If they got an old scrapped F-14 out of the junkyard, could it kill one of these things in the space of 10 minutes or what?
I don't know about the time frame, but they're certainly more effective. I mean, the F-35 is trying to do so many things at once that it's not really doing any of them very well. But certainly, you know, I think because they're designed for a specific purpose, the other aircraft that are in the inventory would do a better job.
I actually saw an interview with the guy that designed the F-15 and 16 saying that the F-35 works perfectly at its actual mission, which is transferring taxpayer money to Lockheed. That's what it's for in the first place, and it's doing great at that, so don't criticize.
It is highly successful doing that, that's for sure.
Now, am I just being too harsh on the thing when I rattle off that list that, you know, you can't fly it within 50 miles of a lightning bolt and all these kinds of things? Is that really true?
All these things are true. I mean, you know, have they tweaked one of them and, you know, fixed it? Maybe. But there's so many things to work on. They've also had problems with the software, which is sort of an endless issue for them. So, you know, they had the engine start on fire and they had to take it out of, flight for weeks and weeks at a time. So, I don't think any of the things you mentioned are, I think they're all accurate.
Because I admit, I sound pretty hyperbolic and, you know, I'm just kind of just going off the top of my head, so it sounds even worse. But then, yeah, no, it's all true. That's the expert opinion. Scott's hyperbole couldn't be much better than that, unfortunately. All right, so now is there any other reason why this thing costs so much? I mean, is it stealthy at all? Or, I mean, is there anything special about this plane, really, that makes it cost so much more than, say, an F-15, which already is pretty expensive, you'd think?
Well, there's a lot of things they're trying to achieve, and even when they fail, it costs some money to make the effort. You know, so they're trying to give it stealth capability. They're trying to make a version that can do vertical takeoff and landing on a marine ship. They're trying to make a version that can land on an aircraft carrier. They're trying to make a version that can do aerial dogfights. They're trying to make a version that can be a bomber and do close air support for troops. So I think part of it is all the compromises and just strange twists that are involved in trying to make an aircraft that can do all those different things. And they originally said it was going to be cheap. It was going to be the Chevrolet of the skies. Although Chevrolets don't really fly that well. But in terms of money, you know, the Chevrolet of the skies. And part of it was because there was going to be all these common components, even though they have different purposes. Well, it ends up the vast majority of the components are not common. So for each different version, each of the three versions, they've got to machine different parts, and they put together slightly differently. And so there's a lot of waste involved in that piece of it also. They're really building three different aircraft with a very compromised design for all of them.
Yeah. It sounds like it could be a weekly comic strip, this F-35. I remember one from a few years ago where the pilot got stuck and the cockpit wouldn't open, and he's stuck on the tarmac for a couple hours so they could, I guess, manufacture the right tool to pry the damn thing apart. Let him out of there. It really seems crazy. But now I remember there was a big fight back a couple of years ago. We may have spoken about this when Robert Gates he actually gave a big speech, really, I think, challenging the Pentagon bureaucracy, or at least part of it, and saying, listen, we're over the F-22 now. And, you know, you might imagine dogfights in the air against a power with, you know, like fighter jets, but that's not likely to happen. Our wars are against civilians on the ground in their own countries, and we need to be able to bomb them on the ground, and the F-35 at least can do that, where the F-22 cannot. And it seems like they actually won that fight. As you wrote in the article, you say in here they ended the F-22. I guess I had thought they were still selling them abroad and that they still had some in the inventory. I'm not sure the details, but you cite that as kind of a victory and maybe a something that we can build off of when it comes to challenging the F-35 itself.
Yeah, well, Lockheed Martin pulled out all the usual arguments, including that it creates a lot of jobs, when actually Pentagon spending is about the poorest way to create jobs one could imagine. And they got, you know, governors to write letters for them and a couple hundred of members of the House of Representatives, and, you know, the Machinist Union was supporting them. But the thing is, it was so expensive and it was so limited in what it could do that, you know, there was a coalition of a combination of conservative deficit hawks and liberalish Democrats who were able to defeat it. And they overcame the pork barrel argument because there were enough people who didn't have PET built in their state, that they were able to vote their conscience without worrying about getting flack back home. But, of course, the problem, which you kind of alluded to, is Gates said, well, yeah, because we have the F-35 in the wings, you know, so we'll be fine.
Right.
And now we're seeing that we're not fine.
Yep. Now, so what is the price of an F-35 compared to an F-15 or an F-16? Because I know that those things aren't cheap either, right?
Well, there's various ways of calculating it, but one commonly used price for the F-35 is around $120 million. And an F-35 could be 50 or 60, F-16 even less than that. So you're talking about at least twice and sometimes three times as much to buy one F-35 as to buy a current generation aircraft.
Mm-hmm. And then, so what's wrong with the F-16s and 15s? I mean, I guess they're not stealthy, but do they really need to be? Who are they going up against anyway?
Well, that's the issue. I mean, you know, the whole argument of the Air Force and the Pentagon is we need a fifth generation fighter plane, which basically means, you know, primarily more stealth characteristics and able to move more quickly and accelerate more quickly and so forth, none of which the F-35 is doing very well. But, yeah, the mission, you know, I mean, hasn't been a war that the United States has been in a long, long time where the other side had an Air Force to speak of, much less an aircraft that could shoot down U.S. planes. So there was no need for you know, the fanciest fighter in the world, even if the F-35 could meet that standard. And so all you have left is China. And are we really going to have aerial dogfights with Chinese fighter planes, two nuclear powers duking it out on China's border? I don't think so. You know, so I think that the China threat is kind of just a demon that's placed out there to help, you know, get money from the taxpayers more than a realistic threat in terms of needing fighter planes to confront them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially, I mean, it doesn't sound like even on its very best day, grading it on a curve, an F-35 would be any better for fighting the Chinese Air Force than a fleet of F-16s and F-15s would be. In fact, they've already, they're on like Service Pack 3, so they've kind of worked out their bugs over these years, you know.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, thanks for your great article, and thanks for your time again on the show, William. I appreciate it.
Yes, great talking to you.
That's William Hartung, everybody. He's at the Center for International Policy. Follow him at William Hartung on Twitter. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I guess I couldn't think of two segments worth of questions for William. But anyway, yeah, that F-35, that's a hell of a thing. What a piece of junk. Oh, I meant to ask him. He writes in here, McCain has actually said some pretty good things about how bad the F-35 is before and how maybe that's something that could be built on, but... Anyway, I don't know. It's not a very good question anyway, is it? All right. It's almost lunchtime, man. Almost there. All right. So Almari has been released. Remember him. Now, reading up on him, seems like, yeah, he was working for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and they had his ass. At least he admitted to it in his plea deal, but then again, you know, I don't know, man. But here's the deal with him. Ali Saleh Almari.
he was arrested at a community college in Peoria. You know, like, how's this going to play in Peoria? Like, the most kind of plain old average middle American silent majority kind of a sleepy old American town. Did I say American? American town. Peoria. And he was arrested at a community college there by civilian police. And then he was turned over to Donald Rumsfeld as an enemy combatant. Was held by, that was the Secretary of Defense at the time, kids. And held as an enemy combatant outside of any rule of law. And the thing of it is, eventually the court said, you can't do that. Or I guess maybe they were just afraid that the court was going to say you can't do that. And that was why they went ahead and indicted Jose Padilla and Almari. Both of whom, Padilla was an American citizen, both of whom should have been completely covered by the Bill of Rights either way. Arrested on American soil, no question. And, but anyway, so, they ended up putting him in prison and they gave him a plea deal. And, so I think the plea deal was something like they gave him, 8 years and he's out in six or something like that. After being held without any law or any lawyer or any kind of process for years and years by the military, and certainly the majority of that in solitary confinement, I say time served. I mean, they say that he was looking up soft targets. He wanted to poison people with chlorine. I don't know, man. I don't know if I believe that at all. Oh, hey, there's a problem. Oops. I don't know if I believe that at all. I don't know who actually is good on Almari's story, but it doesn't matter, because even if he was sent here to, commit an act of Al-Qaeda terrorism, he should have got a trial just like Moussaoui got a trial. And they were just setting the precedent that we're the government, we don't have to obey the law. That's what they mean when they say unitary executive and, invoke the inherent and plenary powers of the presidency. What they mean is, anyone who's a member of the executive branch can do anything they want, and nobody can stop them, and no one can hold them accountable at all. And watch, we can tap your phones, we can arrest people, we can arrest American citizens on American soil, and hold them, have the CIA torture them, as the CIA did to Jose Padilla in custody in Donald Rumsfeld's custody in South Carolina. And what are you going to do about it? Just like George Bush's speech after the NSA spying scandal broke, again, James Risen, in 2005. Bush the next day gave a press conference where he said, look, we've been accused of violating this FISA statute. You're damn right. What are you going to do about it? And that was it. You know, there's a scene like that. Sorry to break whatever guy's law or whatever, but there's a scene like that in The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and I forget who it was that Hitler murders. He murders somebody. In fact, it may even be when he turns on the SA, and it's a bit of a scandal, and then Hitler says, hey, look, he gives a big speech, and he says, I am the supreme judge of the German people, not law, me, and how that was kind of a big, oh, wow, we're crossing the Rubicon even more now here, kind of a step on the way, and that maybe people could have said no, and that there were factions in power who could have said, actually not, get back down into your place, but they didn't. And it's not a perfect analogy, but yeah, it sort of is perfect. George Bush said, yes, I am guilty of millions and millions and millions of violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, all punishable by years in prison and millions of dollars in fines. And what are you going to do about it, America? What are you going to do about it, opposition party in Congress? Nothing. That's what I thought. I am the supreme judge around here, he said. And that was it. And that's all they mean with all that, pretended legalistic language about plenary power and unitary executive. And that's what they were going for with Almari. Cheney, at one point, even when they had the Lackawanna Six, the guys who were, you know, basically nobodies and who were intimidated into pleading guilty by being threatened with being turned over to the CIA to be tortured. But back when they were arrested, Cheney wanted to send the army to arrest them, just to set the precedent that we can roll Humvees down the streets in Lackawanna, New York. Is that really the name of the place? I guess stole it from the Indians. Lackawanna, New York. And Bush said, nah, just send the FBI. I guess, you know, thanks to the cool, calm, rational wisdom of George W. Bush, that precedent wasn't set right then and there. As bad as Cheney wanted to. But anyway, so Almari's been released. He's back in Qatar, and I guess it remains to be seen what he's going to do now. But it seems to me, I'd be willing to bet he was tortured. I don't know if he was tortured or not, but he was certainly held without law for years and years in isolation. It seems to me like time served is good enough there. Because he didn't actually kill anybody, right? They say he was sent on a mission, and he got busted. That's pretty bad. Working for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, I disapprove, but yeah. Anyway, an important note there about Jose Padilla is that he didn't do it. You know, they claim that one of the reasons that torture is so important is because the proof of it is that they tortured Jose Padilla's name out of Abu Zubaydah, the Al-Qaeda guy. Well, Abu Zubaydah wasn't Al-Qaeda, and they didn't torture Jose Padilla's name out of him. He gave it to the FBI before the CIA torturers ever showed up. And so, yeah, Jose Padilla had been to Afghanistan and had met these guys, but he had made up, he and his buddy Binyam Mohammed had just made up a ridiculous story about, oh, yeah, we're going to go and do a nuclear attack on America. If you just let us go home, let us leave here. We promise we'll carry out your will. Maybe there was something to, they wanted to try something. I don't know. But then what happened was the CIA tortured Binyam Mohammed with razor blades to his parts in a dungeon in Morocco, which, as the New York Times is reporting this week, the Moroccan government put into full-time use after the CIA was done with it for torturing all their own dissidents. That's America spreading democracy to the world, bringing barbarism to Morocco. And anyway, they tortured this guy with razor blades until he implicated Jose Padilla in a bomb plot, a dirty bomb plot. And then it turned out that they were just talking about an article that ran in the Rolling Stone back in the 1970s. And it was actually that L.A. Times journalist or columnist turned Obama administration associate, I forgot, deputy secretary or something in the Labor Department or whatever, Rosa Brooks. It was her mother had written the thing in the first place. And you can even find it, I think, online, how to make a nuclear weapon in your mom's kitchen or something. And it includes you take the uranium in a and you put it in a bucket and you spin it around and around over your head until it's enriched and ready to, you know, be fissile material. And the whole thing is a joke. The whole thing is a complete joke. And they tortured Binyam Mohammed into pretending it was a real thing. And then John Ashcroft, the American Attorney General at the time, from a press conference in Moscow, in a hotel right there off of Red Square, announced that Jose Padilla had been arrested and was being turned over to the FBI, I mean, to the Defense Department and the CIA to be tortured outside of the rule of law, based on a tortured lie. When they eventually indicted him, it had none of that in there.